Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We just took a very brief break here. I want you to, we're keeping with us here, Dr. Marisela Gomez. You just heard Michael Scott, Charles Ellison. Joining us also now is Diamante Brown, who is director of Out for Justice, an ex-offender-led membership-based organization that advocates for reform of policies affecting people who reenter society. And John Cohen will be joining us here in studio shortly. And Eddie Conway is joining us by phone, who is now an executive producer with Real News Network and, of course, a former leader of the Black Panthers and political prisoner in this country for 43 years. And all of you at 410-319-8888. So, you know, I don't think – when I was thinking about the local issues here and how they kind of easily kind of meld in and bridge from the conversation that we were having about the national issues and reparations because of Ta-Nehisi Coates' article, Marisela, and you talk about where and how money is being spent or not spent in our communities. I don't think those discussions are necessarily disconnected. Marisela?
Yeah, are you asking about – are you asking me to continue what I was saying, or what are you asking?
I'm trying to build a bridge between the conversation we had about – the national issues that we were just wrestling with and the reparations that came up and how that part of the political process, how that process works, and this argument being taken place now in Baltimore and Maryland around the questions of money coming into Baltimore for demolition. What does that really mean? Whether the money gets here or not is another question. And who controls that money? And I think they're part of the same question.
Yes, absolutely. I think we have the liability, the history that the money that has come in for any big major redevelopment or any change in the areas that we so desperately need to help in transformation, that the money goes to the same group of people, the same pipeline that have existed, the same politicians who sort of are so connected. And this includes our Black politicians. We have a big critique for this, the way our Black city council leadership has basically given the land over to the developers in different tax breaks, in urban renewal policy, in eminent domain. I mean, we see that in East Baltimore and Hopkins, what happened there with 88 acre turned over to for Hopkins development. So I think we're on the same thing, Republican voice, Democratic voice. We're right now at the same threshold. How are we going to make sure that those funds don't get distributed into the same pipeline that takes the money, and by the time you're finished administering the money, there's very little left? We saw that in the empowerment zone. we continue to see it. So I'm all on board for how are we going to make sure, and I'm so glad that there's someone from Communities United on the show today to talk about some of the more grassroots ways that those funds can be really redistributed into some of the spaces that very seldom those monies will get distributed into.
So, you know, I the politics of this is really interesting because this also has to do with the politics of the inside and outside that Charles Ellison and we were wrestling with before we went to break. And I think it speaks volumes to where we are right now in the city. And as Charles pointed out, what happened in Flint, we're going to see the Flintonization of cities in America across the country. We can easily see that tumbling out. I think Charles is actually right about that. I'm looking forward to the piece that comes out that he writes about that so we can wrestle with that on the air. But let me just go around the room here real fast and just talk about this kind of transition here. I think it's really important. And let me go first to Eddie, a caller at 410-319-8888, then turn to Eddie Conway and Diamante Brown and back to other guests who have gathered here. Eddie, online too, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, good morning.
Morning.
I have a comment and a question. My comment is I understand you talk about reparation, and it's okay, but what my thinking is that reparation could come in the form of free tuition for all universities, for Black youth, you know, and our descendants from slaves, you know, and our free or health, hospitalization, everything, because this is what should have been done for Black folks for all these years that are neglected, and also, you know, for housing, you know, to stop homelessness, and all these things should come in the form of reparation. I don't understand why that people should get out and vote so that they can let their voice be heard to the politicians, so that they can do the right thing for the people in the city, because it's very important. You know, you're not going to get reparation from Congress or from the Senate. You'll get it from people organizing themselves and make sure they put people in the right places to do the right thing for the people.
Eddie, I appreciate the call. Thank you so much. And I want to turn here to early in the day, we were talking about, this is a very large panel we have now for the next 45 minutes or so, so we're going to give everybody a chance to get in here and get their voices in. But Eddie Conway is on the air with us along with Dominique Stevenson, and we were talking this morning on the phone. Just the immediate reaction to looking at what the Sun reported about this, about the demolitions, how they're going to happen, who's controlling the money, what's really going to happen in the city, if anything, in the battles in Annapolis. And Dominic, I'm glad you two are here. But what you said to me on the phone this morning, I think, gets to the heart of the matter. I'd like you to throw it out there so our panel can wrestle with this.
Yeah, one, I think it feels very manipulative. It's like, okay, you take a vulnerable population. Obviously, people coming out of prison need jobs. You kind of throw that out there, but you put in the mix a nonprofit that's going to siphon off that money and still pay these folks a minimal amount, when the reality is we could focus more on rebuilding rather than demolition. Why not rebuild communities? Why aren't we putting money directly, you know, into the hands of folks? I do like the idea of supporting some type of entrepreneurial model, but the money is going into the hands of people who really need it versus into the hands of a nonprofit.
Yeah. Eddie, go ahead.
Yeah, you know, and I was looking at one of the things that came out in that article is like almost $700,000 was dedicated to demolishing 50 houses, which is like about $14,000 per house. And then I was looking at the amount of money, $11 or $12, that the workers are getting. And it kind of reminded me of slavery by any other name. And the fact is, we need jobs. Obviously, everybody in the city needs jobs. Everybody that gets out of the prison system needs jobs. That's no question about it. But when you give them a wage that will just barely sustain them, because we know that the cost of living now in this state and other states is about $15 an hour, you know. So, one, you're just barely making ends meet when you're making $10 or $11. I mean, it's good that they have jobs and that jobs available. But I think one of the things that has to happen is you just can't have manual labor, the same old chain gang process, that same old thing, without training people to become managers in this process, without training them to become engineers in the process, without training them to come owners or have some buy-in in these nonprofits. You know, I was looking at the one that's actually dedicated. I mean, no money is first place put aside in terms of what the governor is doing anyway. All this is conjecture. He's talking about, well, we're going to put money up. We're going to write it in later on. We won't go back on our word, but we've heard that before. And we also know that in most cases, when that money gets put up, it'll end up in some construction or deconstruction company in the county that's friends or associates of people that supported his campaign. You know, so we have to be aware of that. What sounds good now, 6 months from now, might not even come into fruition. You know, so we need to be aware of that and on top of that also. But in addition to that, we need to train people to run and have ownership in these, either whether they're nonprofits or whatever kind of organization they are, and not just be the manual labor, the hands that clean the bricks. You know, I think that's important, and that's, as long as we keep cleaning bricks, we'll be cleaning bricks into the 22nd century.
Amen on that.
I wanted Eddie and Dominique to start this off, just to cut this, the thoughts they gave me this morning. I thought were important to contextualize this discussion we're having. I want to get to our guests who just walked in the door here, Diamante and John Comer. Diamante, go ahead. Your thoughts on what you heard Eddie and Dominique say before we have to hit this break.
Oh, well, I, of course, wholeheartedly agree with Eddie and Dominique. And I think that, like they said, this is, it's nice. It's a nice offer. But as ex-offenders, it becomes tiring to always get offered the bare minimum. And that's something that our city, our state, unfortunately, is known for. We give people free lunches, but it's the bare minimum free lunch. We give people jobs, but it's the bare minimum job. We give people training, but it's the bare minimum training. And, you know, I think that we should focus more of our efforts on, of course, passing laws that disallow employers to use people's criminal records as a barrier to employment. Instead of trying to carve out these small niches of employers and these small training programs that can only service a small amount of people, knowing that the real issue is that there's a stigma on ex-offenders that keeps us from being employed. There's a much, much bigger issue. It's not a lack of jobs. It's a lack of wanting us to work there.
So we have to get a very short break here because we have a news break we have to take at the top of the hour. We're going to come right back and hit John Comer, and we're going to let us back in here. I want to hear Maricela's thoughts because of the book she wrote and how this fits what happened in East Baltimore, what lessons we learned from that in terms of what we're about to see in this demolition. I have a list of all the houses here about to be demolished. It's interesting where they are and how that takes place and what that means. So we'll come back to all that with your thoughts at 410-319-8888. Stay with us. Don't go away. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and we are here with a great deal of guests, good people. Charles Ellison remains with us, political strategist, author of the Ellison Report. We also have Dr. Maricela Gomez, physician, community activist who wrote the book Race, Class, Power, and Organizing East Baltimore, Rebuilding Abandoned Communities in America. Diamante Brown joins us as well. She is director for Out for Justice. Eddie Conway, former leader of the Black Panthers, who political prisoner for 43 years, now executive producer at the Real News Network, Baltimore's Bureau. Dominique Stevenson, program director for the American Friends Service Committee and co-author with Eddie of Martial Law. John Comer, lead organizer for Maryland Communities United. And also Michael Scott, chief equity officer, president, CEO, founder of Equity Matters, and you at 410-319-8888. So, I mean, this is... You know, when we say in the last segment that we are in the midst of a place where, because of people like Ta-Nehisi Coates and others, we're having a debate and discussion on reparations this country has not had in ever, really. They really talk about it in a way that's affected beyond the community. But now I think, given what happened in Baltimore with the uprising after the death of Freddie Gray almost a year ago in April, the governor coming to town saying he's got the $700 million, which I think most people think is not real money because it's not in the budget, but has raised the issue of what this development means and this demolition of houses that have already been listed. And I have the list in front of me of the houses all across Baltimore that are to be demolished. It's a huge list that goes throughout the east and west side of this town. So the question is, what does that mean for us? I mean, you know, when you look at this, and we're talking about the most devastated communities in Baltimore, John Comer, communities where you are a community organizer, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, what are your thoughts on what discussions are taking place for the community out?
I think there are many reasons to be skeptical. You know, you can start with just the history of the local government. You can look at the laws, the land covenants that used to exist in Baltimore when people couldn't move to a certain area. And you could point out the plan to get 10,000 new people, new residents to move into the city. And then you can look at the opportunities or the lack of opportunities that have been presented for ex-felons in the past and begin to ask, are they being hired for pennies to deconstruct their own communities? And when the reconstruction begins, are they going to be around for those jobs and be able to move into those houses? So, of course, you know, we always want to bring and create more job opportunities for people who, for those who have been pushed out of the system. But many times we have to look around to the back door to see what's coming in and what's going out the back door, because up front, some of it may sound okay, but, you know, we need to ask a lot more questions.
And Maricela, before we go around the room here, but I want to read this piece. Someone sent me an email, and I'm not going to read who it's from because it was an email to me, not necessarily to the program, but I think it's relevant to what we're facing. Let me just read this quick email that was sent in on this matter, as a matter of fact, which is odd. Some of your guests have commented on the state's tentative offer of funds to expedite demolition of vacant houses in the city. They seem to assume that people are going to be displaced, which may or may not be true. The only reason this would be done is if they live in an otherwise vacant block. They further seem to assume people living in such a block do not want to be relocated, a very debatable proposition, particularly if they are a homeowner and able to sell an otherwise worthless home, to now be able to sell their house at many times its value. A list of properties, this is where I got the list of properties from this email. They were chosen by the city, not the state, and are already slated for demolition. The process is just being speeded up. The city maintains that in most, not all cases, the relevant community groups have requested demolition. This is just a continuation of a process underway for several years. Why the sudden concern? As you see from the list, the sites are throughout the city and have no connection to the hypothetical $700 million in state development money. Describing this process as urban renewal and removal is totally inappropriate. So let's wrestle with that idea. I mean, this is a discussion that we are about to have and need to have. And what we think about that, and what in the context of that, Maricela, let me turn to you first, and then go back to Eddie Dominique and come over to Charles, because I'm curious how you hear that in the context of your work in East Baltimore and the book you wrote to analyze all of that when it came to Hopkins expansion.
Yeah, you know, it's true that there are many blocks that need to be deconstructed. I think the base of all this is that residents have to be involved in which blocks are demolished and which blocks stay and are redeveloped or renovated. This is the big lesson from the 88-acre near Hopkins. The city, the state, didn't consult residents. They just decided which blocks would go. Residents were left to find out about it in a newspaper, not unlike this one. And the lesson was residents wanted to have revitalization, but they wanted to be involved, and they wanted to find out how affordable housing could be built in areas that were pretty much already demolished, so that if their block had to be demolished, if they were on, say, a scenario you just described, where it's one house or two houses on an otherwise abandoned block, so those folks could move into some affordable housing in their community, benefit from the revitalization, and not have to be displaced outside, and then think about whether or not they could come back 3 or 4 or 5 years later, which decreases the chances that they'll come back. So I think no one argues that we need to have massive change and transformation in the communities. The question is, how is it going to be done? Are residents at the decision-making table? Are affordable housing going to be built so people can make one move from where they are and into the ones where they can stay in the community? The big question has to be, can people stay and benefit from the transformation of the community? People who have lived through the crime and the grime, as folks say. Mm-hmm. This is what people want. You know, people are scared. When I talk to folks in East Baltimore, they're scared about the current development that Hopkins is doing there. They're scared that in time they're going to have to move because the rents are going up so quickly. So if you piggyback back on now this massive demolition that's going to clear out more spaces, take any affordable housing that might be there still, it increases the stress on the fare for folks who are there. They're wondering, are they going to be able to stay in this community? If we don't start allotting construction of affordable housing into some of these spaces that are going to be cleared,
right,
we're going to continue to lose our population of the city. We're going to keep preparing it for the 10,000 residents that we want to bring and gentrify and glamorize the city. I mean, we have to just deal with the understanding of what these historic projects have done. We don't have good examples in Baltimore City. Can we do it different this time? Can we take this supposed... And let me... last thing I'm going to share here is that that money is available. Money is always available when people have the will to prioritize something. So if we can hold this down as the money that is available, come up with a plan that's people-generated, people-decided, involving those who might bring expertise so that they can advise on the advice of the experience of the community, then hold that money and make it come into places and pockets that usually don't get. Don't let it go into these nonprofits. It has to be entrepreneurial. Let's get into co-ops. Let's get into owner-owned businesses. Enough of these nonprofits just taking 60% of the money that comes into rehabbing our communities. We have so many examples of that happening. Can we just do it differently this time?
This is a thing. What you laid out here is something I want to get. I'm glad you were here to do that, because I think that at the heart of the issue is how this is going to be done, who benefits from it. And I think Eddie and Dominique, when we talked this morning, I mean, that clearly is part of what's motivated your kind of angst about what's really going to happen here.
Yeah, one of the things, you know, and I agree fully with everything that's just been said. One of the things that's important, a piece to add to that, is that when you disrupt these neighborhoods by deconstructing them and scatter the residents all over the place, it creates hostile environments where people move in. They're strangers. There's no roots. There's no ties. There's no connections. There's no network. And it creates other neighborhoods. It helps to destroy and deconstruct other neighborhoods. And if you look at the what Hopkins have done, and you see the relocation of a lot of those people out the Bel Air corridor, and then you look at the violence and the crime statistics, and you find that migration also took the crime and stuff away and put it in another community, and now those communities are being deconstructed and those houses are being devalued and abandoned. And so we really do need to save the neighborhoods. We really do need to reconstruct the neighborhoods right there, keep the people there, and put that money there, and as was said, use the expertise, but make sure 80 or 90% of that money that's in development and in that project stay in that community, so that those people in the community can even start learning those skills and they can start having the affordability to make that neighborhood viable, to bring back life in the neighborhood again. And I think that's not what's happening. New people are coming in, the old people are going out, and they lose their sense. I mean, generations. When I grew up, in our neighborhoods, we had generations of people living in the neighborhood. Now the neighborhoods are collapsed and completely gone. That's got to be turned around in order for us to say we can rebuild the city with the people in the city.
This is a critical piece of it. I'm going to go to all of our guests here with comments on this before we run out of time here. But let me go to John and Charles and then back to Diamante and to Michael Scott. We get everybody in here with these thoughts and try to get a couple calls in here as well. John?
I completely agree with everything that's been said and everything that Mr. Conway said. And the email had said that it seems that, you know, people are assuming that certain things are going to happen. But I think history says that. So the people have the right to actually be skeptical and fear what's going on, or not necessarily fear, but like be skeptical. It's very important that if we're going to use the term to be smart on crime, that we have to do smart redevelopment. So anytime that there's an opportunity for things to be redeveloped in the city, of course you use the people, the local people that are there. Many times the actions speak to doing otherwise, and it just seems that there's no need to help ex-felons out. I mean, for instance, the pay, the $11.86. You know, part of our platform at Communities United is raising the minimum wage in Baltimore to $15 an hour. And this is all connected to the same people in the communities where that are going to experience some of this demolition. So, I really don't like politics because in Baltimore is so much of a human issue that we just have to get down to the bottom of admitting where things have gone wrong in mm-hmm. the system and cleaning it up.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's an important point, Charles, to jump in, because, I mean, you can take that example from Highway to Nowhere
right.
to what happened in East Baltimore. All the 40 years of dislocation leads to a deep mistrust, and for reason.
Yeah, everybody making some really strong, cogent points here. We've seen this episode before, right? It's right down the road, Washington, D.C., just a neighboring city right next to us. And so, you know, anytime I think it's definitely not an inappropriate discussion. I would really push back against whomever wrote that email. It's a very essential discussion, particularly when we start talking about development, disruption, demolition. You know, and rather than talking about, you know, even economic development, you know, we really need to have a conversation about growth, you know, so we can figure out a very smart and also very compassionate way in which we can make these changes. Because, you know, clearly you do need to do something about these vacant houses in Baltimore. I mean, they just can't sit there. You do need to do something that can radically reshape and transform Baltimore, but doing it in a way that doesn't trigger the mass displacement of entire populations or undesirables in the city of Baltimore. Because what I'm seeing here, and we saw this play out in D.C., is, okay, so you're going to get a bunch of underserved felons or felons who otherwise wouldn't get a job. You're going to use them to then demolish these vacant buildings, basically because you're just paving the way for hyper-gentrification. That's all that's happening. And then, you know, and so, right. the person in that email is saying, well, you know, well here's an opportunity for original residents to then see an increase in their home values and to sell their homes. Well, that's if they have the luxury of sticking around long enough through elevated taxes, you know, to sell their home. And then what's going to happen is then you're going to have suddenly all the, you know, these underserved populations here in Baltimore getting scattered out into the suburbs. And there's already been a lot of research. It was Brookings Institution right down the road here in D.C. has done a lot of copious research into the growth of suburban poverty. That's what we're starting to see. So you even see it like around Washington, D.C. You see these suburban rings of poverty where underserved black population, low-income black populations that used to live in D.C. are forced to move out into the suburbs. And then suddenly all of that, all of, you know, some of those issues, those challenges are being shifted into the suburbs. So you're not really doing anything to attack or address the core problem. You're just moving it all over the place. And so it's a very essential conversation that we have to have, and stop focusing so much on development. We have to start thinking about growth and growth for everyone and how everyone can benefit from that type of growth and prosperity.
And I think that the growth for everyone, I think, is key to this. And you're talking about D.C. The first neighborhood that pops in my head is the U Street corridor.
Right.
Which was a poor and working class black community that is now totally gentrified. 14th mm-hmm. and U back in the mm-hmm. day was Pennsylvania North. It's nowhere near that right now.
Real quick point, and the crime spikes that we're seeing in D.C. is chickens coming home to roost, not just with that gentrification, but with such things as like the infrastructure, it's like lead poisoning, that lead poisoning crisis that happened in D.C. about a decade ago that nobody wants to talk about. Those kids are growing up. And so now, you know, white folks that have moved in, gentrified places like Capitol Hill, U Street Corridor, they're like all like surprised, like, oh, this crime, where is it coming from? It's like, well, you know, the roosted chickens grew up, you know, pretty much.
Michael Scott, let me jump back to you before we go to Diamante and talk a bit about, well, how you see in the work you do in terms of trying to push planning, how this might work in a different way.
Yeah, no, I think it's been a sympathetic panel, and I think, you know, those most affected and those advocates most connected have to lead the way. And, you know, the email that you read really is, you know, missing the point about culture and different ways of being, right? The only conversation of values was around market values and not cultural values of valuing the participation of those most affected, which solves for most of this stuff, right? At the regional level, and Ellis is right, is that, you know, you're creating essentially a Soweto model, right? Where you're pushing poor folks further out, and it's even harder to get transportation and get to work for jobs that are not at the fair, at a 15 or working wage. And so I think the other point that has to be pointed out is that when you have a culture which truly values those most affected and not in a token way, then some of the existing laws on the books can actually, I mean, we already have laws, you know, affirmatively affirming fair housing has provisions to hire people locally. We don't enforce those. And that gets back to the larger point that we were making in the earlier segment, which is around political imagination and what we expect of those who are supposed to represent us. And the fact is that all of our gatekeepers, but particularly our black gatekeepers and our people of color, have to be held to a higher standard. They need actually new tools because they think they're doing the right thing, but they don't have the right tools in a modern a political and policy context to solve and to involve the population that they're supposed to be representing. So there's a re-education and a new level of accountability that has to occur so that those most affected and those that are most connected in their advocacy can be heard and we can start to solve some of this stuff.
Diamante, well, I have another question, but let me let you jump in here. I haven't heard from you in a few minutes.
Oh, well, I think everyone pretty much summed it up. I would just want to add that I think that we should maybe in the future start talking about strategy. How do we get at the table? Because we continuously keep talking about we're not at the table, we're not involved in the process, we're not this, we're not that. And I think we don't spend enough of our energies working on how do we make that happen so that we don't, this doesn't happen next time.
I mean, one of the things I think is true here that, is that, I mean, people who live in communities where you might have two, three, one house in the midst of abandoned houses all around you, A, the people in those houses cannot get house insurance.
Mm-hmm.
So, they do not get house insurance. So they're living on the edge every moment of the day, even if their home is intact inside.
Right.
And you know, the couple has been there for 50 years and their house is looking good on the inside, they can't protect their home.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, what is then the plan? I mean, the city is going to move ahead with these demolitions. Mm-hmm. That's clear. There's deconstruction arguments that you deconstruct a house, which is getting crews, which mostly people who have served time working for Humanum or some other nonprofit, who go in and tear the house down brick by brick, and then you sell the brick and sell what's in the house. And then there's the other model, which calls in a demolition company from the county to come in and just destroy the house. And most black folks in the city who need a job don't get a job in that kind of demolition, where most of the money is being made.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that. And then, but layer on top of that is what has to happen, how you build a model that does something different. What do you do to protect the people who live in that community now and give them options about what they want to do with their own lives and community while you're rebuilding a community? And rebuilding a community means you're bringing in private investment. Mm-hmm. You're bringing in private investment. How do you ensure that there are affordable houses for poor people, working people, and middle-class people to be able to afford the homes that are being built?
Right.
And how do you do that? And that to me, John Comer, as an organizer, mm-hmm. let me go around the room here real fast with that, is the heart of the matter. I mean, what is it people are saying to the power structure about what should happen instead, and how do you do that?
Well, you know, on this issue, you know, we haven't delved in it very deeply, but I would say that everything that I look at how we can create a groundswell, and you know, organizing is the most important key to nearly everything that we do. But in the process, I just feel like what's not being highlighted and what has to be highlighted by many of the residents in Baltimore is that the same government that is deconstructing the neighborhoods played a role in constructing and deconstructing people. So the same reasons why these houses are vacant, they came from the government. So when it comes to one family who doesn't have insurance because they don't have any neighbors, and there's being money provided to deconstruct this, the responsibility falls on the shoulders of the local government, the state government, or whoever. And so what we have to do is organize residents, educate residents, and organize them around that, because in order for us to get at the table, we can't ask to get at the table. We can't ask to sit there. We have to show up and sit down.
And I think that requires, mm-hmm. it seems to me, before we run out of time completely, Let me go to Eddie or Dominique, who's ever on the phone there. That requires kind of a political organizing for people to kind of come together to come up with a plan that's an alternative to the plan that is always being foisted on the people. That's part of the issue.
Yeah, that's part of the issue. I think one of the other things is that we have to think in more radical, revolutionary ways. Honestly, let's take some of these properties. You know, let's start occupying them. Let's put some of our nonprofit money where our mouths are. Why don't we start trying to take these properties and do some things with those that can be renovated, that can be utilized for communities? I think part of what I struggle with this whole plan and with the politics here in Baltimore is that it's a very mercenary setup. I don't think that any of these folks are well-intentioned. I think that their intentions are pretty clear as long as they're participating in that political system. I feel like we have at some point, and this is funny because the person who wrote that email, I guess, couldn't imagine or assume that some of us are just coming from a place of love. Okay, we don't want to see these things happen to the community, and we've seen these things continually occur. We've seen nothing good happen for many communities here in Baltimore. So it's a matter of, you know, trying to stop this stuff from happening, to change the tide, to change people's lives. You know, it's like that to me is what's absent in all of this, is that these plans are not derived from love or care or concern for these folks. And then when folks do come into the conversation, they're mentioned as labels, ex-felons, whatever. You know, these are human beings. These are people who want the same things we all want.
Charles, and then I'm going to go to Maricel to close this out.
Yeah, real quick comment on all of this, and really great discussion, is that, you know, we keep applying outdated, conventional personal finance and banking models and Wall Street-inspired funding, or, you know, how to handle these situations, non-adaptable models to poor people's situations. And so that's where that some of that revolutionary rethinking of, you know, and you have, you know, the person who wrote that email is just removed from the life experiences of low-income, underserved, or vulnerable populations living in Baltimore. So they just can't understand it. It's not their fault. It's just they can't grasp it. And that's a big part of the problem. So, you know, we're going to have to rethink how we, you know, when low-income or poor people are having personal finance situations, when they're either living paycheck to paycheck or they don't have assets or savings, you know, we keep saying, okay, we'll just take this Wall Street banking model that everybody else uses, that every other, you know, middle class person that's in a Citibank commercial uses, and that should work. And it doesn't work because they have a different set of circumstances, a different set of problems and challenges. And so that's something else that, you know, beyond sort of the policy and political remaking, we're also going to have to look at creating new kinds of financial response models that truly make sure that people are building assets in these communities and make sure that they are truly on a real personal level becoming financially empowered. And that's not happening either.
So we as we wrap up here, Maricel, we only have a couple minutes left. What I was thinking about is listening to everybody speak, and what Charles just said is that, you know, we live in an era now that is very different than it was 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. In the 60s and 70s, there was a lot of federal money that came in to communities, and some of that money was controlled by black folks in their communities and poor people in their communities as they made this transition. And as that money was taken away from the 70s to the 80s, we transition into a model where all development has to do with private money and private investment, which changed the entire paradigm and changed everything about how we do things. And it means that black folks were out completely because it became private companies and nonprofits managing this world and not the way it was. And so when we talk about using different financial models, that's where I think we get stuck. Mm-hmm. Not saying it's wrong, Charles, mm-hmm. but where we get stuck because we've got to figure out what is that model that we create that is different than is being done, and can we create that model in this 21st century mm-hmm. capitalist world? Can we do that? Maricela?
I think we can, and we have examples from different places. For example, when the plan was announced to take 88 acres in East Baltimore back to give to Hopkins, we organized, we door knocked, we asked people in that community, what do you want to see? We formed an organization, State Release Action Committee. We demanded a place at the table, and we put the demands of the residents on the table. It shifted the focus. It didn't shift it to where we wanted it, but it shifted it. There are models in California. Same thing. People went out, door knocked. They were going to build a plaza. They asked people, do you want participation in the plaza? Yes.
people were able to invest. As a little, I don't remember how small, but the investment amount was like as little as $100. People became co-owners of that plaza. They became investors in their community. They didn't have to leave because some new gig was coming into town. There are models out there. The question is, are we willing to use some of this money to build the infrastructure so that our communities can self-organize and become decision makers in this process? Are we willing to give the money so that people can listen, hear what the experience and the wisdom of the community has to offer? If we're willing to do that, then we change the whole paradigm. We can shift this thing. There are models of co-ops. We've got co-ops in Baltimore. On Saturday, we have a Solidarity Economics Forum happening that's going to teach about how do we transition from a capitalist business model into a more worker-owned model. So we have ways to do this. The question is, do we have the incentive to just shift this paradigm of capitalism, of a market-rate economy? Like Dominique said, are we willing to build the beloved revolution? Because if we are, we can do this.
This is really a fascinating discussion. Where is this, by the way, before we have to break here, where is this conversation taking place, Maricela? Is it open to the public?
On Saturday from 10 to 5 at the Impact Hub on North Avenue. Saturday.
Open to everybody?
Open to, there's a sliding scale, $1 to $25, but no one will be turned back if they don't have money.
Well, if you can email me that information, we'll start announcing it this week so people will know about that.
Great.
I didn't even know about that, so I'm glad I do now.
There's a community land trust discussion on Thursday at 11 a.m. at University of Maryland School of Social Work. Someone from Dudley Street is going to come and talk about how they did it differently. Right. There's going to be a report out from the Public Justice Center on this.
I just have to take a break here, but Maricela, if you email that stuff, we'll get that out on the airwaves and get those discussions here on the air. This is really important. Please do email me with that information. Maricela Gomez, physician, community activist, author of Race, Class, Power, and Organizing in East Baltimore. Michael Scott, chief equity officer, co-founder of Equity Matters, who joined us here in studio, as well as my friend and co-host here, Charles Ellison, political strategist, host of the Ellison Report here in WEAA every Sunday night at 9. Eddie Conway, former Black Panther, political prisoner, and now executive producer of the Real News Network at Baltimore's Bureau, Dominique Stevenson, program director, American Friends Service Committee, co-author with Eddie of the book Martial Law, John Comer, lead organizer for the Maryland Communities United, and Diamante Brown, director of Out for Justice, a really important group of women in this community who are fighting for justice, and most of whom are ex-offenders. We threw out during the snowstorm, a giant net to get a lot of guests in here, and everybody posted. We had a great discussion. People said, you can't do it. We did it. So I want to thank you all for really taking time, and with the listeners, really, really important couple of hours. Thank you all so much. Thank you all very much. We have to take a very brief break, and when we come back, it's time for Michelle, the indie mom of comedy, joining us, one of our guests here frequently. Got a new album out. We're going to switch gears and talk with her about that. Stay with us.